Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Thank you very much, Abdullah and Bilal. And it's nice to be in the Holy of Holies of Barclays Bank. My family has banked with Barclays since I still have my grandfather's bank book from 1910 or something. I'm not sure why it's a family tradition, but I was wondering when I came into this building whether somewhere in the building there is the man who asked me why I have forgotten my mother's maiden name. I do know my mother's maiden name, but he thought I'd got it wrong. Anyway, I'd like to meet him one day. But, enough. Good that we began with this reflection on British Muslim identity and the connection with CMC and its aspirations, its educational purpose, its agenda, and also the reference, of course, to the war now raging in Eastern Europe. CMC actually has connections with that part of the world. We were honoured to receive the Deputy Mufti of the Russian Federation, Damir Hazaret Mukhidinov, and his team several years ago now, and we returned the compliment by visiting the Islamic University in Moscow and exchanging notes on how you do Islam successfully in the context of a European culture. And it's interesting to reflect, again, in the context of this idea that many people think Islam is the new kid on the block, doesn't belong in Europe, that most Muslims in Europe actually live in those three countries, Belarus, the Russian Federation, and Ukraine. And Islam actually reached Russia before Christianity did. So in those places, which is most European Muslims, the discourse of Islam as new, the immigrant, doesn't apply at all. It's a very different and distinctive place, and I think we need to build connections with them, and we have to hope that they will survive this current conflagration. There's plenty of places I'd like to visit. The famous Mazar, Muslim shrine of Haji Kontus, which is in the north of Belarus, which is very ancient, which is visited not just by Muslims, but by local Jewish and Christian communities as well. I'd like to see the famous 18th century tafsir in the Belarusian language, which is written in Belarusian, but using the Arabic script. I'd really like to see that. Those ancient village mosques in Poland, Lithuania, Belarus. Many people in Western Europe don't know that Islam is European. They think that these are people who fell off the boat sort of with the Windrush generation. It's not the case. It's not the case. Islam is part of the European story. We really have to pray that those are a just and decent peace there. The minorities, usually in times of conflict, are the ones who suffer most. Anyway, so CMC is trying to theorize this overlap zone, and those Eastern European places show that there is a sustainable overlap zone between authentic Muslimness and belongingness to the European reality. Now, both of those things are fairly vague, helpfully. And there is an overlap, and there has been an overlap since Cordoba and Ibn Fadlan and Muslim Sicily, and it's not a new exercise. But perhaps it's present today in a particularly intensified form, because we're now not surrounded by and large by the Ahl al-Kitab, but by something else, people without a Kitab, Ahlun bighayri Kitab. And that poses additional challenges. Technocratic, high-paced, development-oriented, materialistic modernity, a consumer society, new attitudes to the family, to gender, to sexuality, to everything being upended in ways that can make us feel that we're not quite sure in what sense we do belong. So it's actually important work. If you visited us, you'll know that we're pretty small physically. But the cultural and theological work that needs to be done is necessarily enormous. But it's fascinating, of course, because you can see that there are medieval overlaps. You can see the way in which Enlightenment thought in Europe and Enlightenment art and literature was inspired by the Islamic world. You can see the Rumi phenomenon now in the United States, at a time when America has finally given up on Afghanistan, those shocking and degrading scenes. And Afghanistan is represented as the archetype of the non-Western, non-white, non-Christian other. It's the kind of dark opposite. It's Mordor for many in the United States. The most popular poet in the United States is actually from Afghanistan. Jalal ad-Din Rumi, who is a mosque imam with this amazing effulgence of loving poetry that has somehow leapfrogged over boundaries of centuries and civilizations to become transformative and helpful to so many middle Americans. So we're interested in bridges like that that already exist. But the work is quite urgent. It's even political, although we're not political. We're not sectarian. We're not Brailvi or Deobandi or any of those things. We're just interested in helping people to learn. And then they can make up their own minds about where they want to be in the Muslim family. But at the same time, we recognize that Islam is increasingly a question for many of our fellow Europeans. One reason why the Brexit vote went the way it did was certain well-timed panic stories coming from the UKIP camp about Turkey joining the European Union and millions of kebab sellers suddenly appearing in Tunbridge Wells. That effectively is the story that put us where we now are. No doubt this building has been upended as a result of Brexit. It's an important central part of our reality now. We haven't yet seen the numbers crunched from last year's census, but I'm pretty sure that the main story that comes out of that will not be racial diversity or gender or whatever other issue might arise, economic stratification. It'll be how many of those Muslims are there now in this country? Because that's what it was in 2011 when those figures were released. The Daily Mail hyperventilated when it saw the number of Muslims in the UK has increased by 60% in the last 10 years. That was true. Office of National Statistics is producing a kind of curve that seems to be logarithmic, and Middle England is not quite sure what that will look like in 50 years' time. But the chances are that it will produce all kinds of stresses and strains. And it's important that our community, which can't really control much of the sort of psychic turbulences of the sort of UKIP mentality, but we can deal with our own issues, or we should be able to. It's essential, of the very first importance, that we have a leadership that can talk sense and that can stop shouting and can recognize that this future engagement with the proliferating Muslim demography amidst the increasing crisis of a collapse in the birth rate of the liberal classes in the UK, that is handled well. And that's really up to us. And the traditional Maulvi Saab probably doesn't even know that this is happening. And if presented with the bright lights on Newsnight and given 20 seconds to justify the Muslim presence, probably won't do a very good job. Let's put it no more strongly than that. The firebrand from wherever will probably play into the hands of our adversaries. It's really important that in the midst of this rapid change, we have leaders who can keep their cool, reassure everyone, and tell the Muslims, tawakkal ala Allah, be calm, relax, don't panic. There's too much panicky freaking out in our communities at the moment, and we should not be a community of that. We're the people of tawheed and tawakkul, after all. We're the people who are supposed to be able to deal with any kind of misfortune. Doesn't always look like that if you go on some of the chat groups and the 4chan discussion boards and the subreddits, and we're jumping and shouting and swearing as much as anybody else is, and that doesn't presage well, I think, for the future of this conversation. So yes, as a very small institution in Cambridge, hardly noticeable, but the work we're doing, if we can expand to employ enough people and to create a proper critical mass of thinkers and throughput enough students, could make a very considerable, even historic difference, because I don't really see anybody else who is doing this. Islamic studies in universities is Oriental studies. You can study Arabic and Persian and Abbasid poetry and Mamluk history, fine, but it doesn't deal with these issues. But the Darul Ulooms and those institutions abroad where many Muslims flock to study are not really geared up to creating this new voice either. If you come back from a madrasa in Indonesia or India or Mauritania or wherever, you will come back with whatever the sheikhs there have been able to teach you, but it's unlikely to be able to deal with what may be an increasingly fraught, even threatening discussion. In any case, we're people of optimism. Early Prophet, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, كان يحب الفأل, used to love optimism, and we should see this as a new frontier for Islam, a new way of engaging, a new way of helping societies, rather than just hoping to be helped by them. We should be rahmatun wa shifat, as the Quran says, a mercy and a healing. That's not always the intention that many of us made when they came here or converted to Islam here, but that should be the intention. We are here to help. We should be a therapeutic presence rather than just grumbling about this and that and begging for stuff. Nobody will really respect us for that. And a culture of victimhood will make things even worse because nobody really respects people who are in that particular silo. We have to be strong, step up, smile, show how we can help in this society that is suffering from so many dysfunctions. So maybe that is the way in which I'm going to get into the formal subject of this evening's discussion. And I don't want to make this too academic. I saw some people last night were nodding slightly as I read my script. So I'm going to try and extemporize a little bit. One of the ways, it seems to me, in which we can most centrally contribute to the current discussions in the West is to recognize that there are a number of crises afoot. 100 years ago, when Muslims started to formulate their sometimes rather apologetic or defiant responses to modernity, the time of Sir Sayyid Ahmed Khan, Muhammad Abdur, Afghani, and that generation, the West was rather different because it was really on a roll. It had conquered the world, literally. It had the Gatling gun and the steam gunboat, and nobody could resist. And there they were, the pink-faced English policeman with his solar helmet on the streets of Alexandria directing the traffic. He was in control. And there was a different kind of mindset which made many Muslims think, well, is it a case of if you can't beat them, join them? And the whole process of the secularization of the Muslim elites then began with a certain sense that this was inevitable. This seemed to be part of a historical process. Some kind of Darwinian process had mysteriously made these people who used to be these sort of painted savages in the muddy forests of Northern Europe, where nobody really wanted to go to explore those places, much nicer to sit in Muslim Spain with the fountains and the orange trees and the sun. Who would want to go up there? But those people ended up conquering the world. Anglo-Saxon Germanic civilization. Who would have imagined it? But this is the situation that we have been confronting. The worm has turned. So we have these elites throughout the Muslim world, sometimes maintaining certain sentimental forms of Muslim piety, sometimes spinning complicated stories about how well we contributed a lot to the Renaissance and we invented water clocks and we translated Aristotle, and so somehow we have a little bit of, we can take a little bit of credit for this thing. A little bit pathetic, really. An inferiority complex, very evident. We invented so many things, so please love us a little bit more. It's fairly transparent. And the other reaction, of course, the salient reaction, was explosions of rage. Let us retreat from this godless civilization into the strictest possible interpretation that we can find in our libraries of our religion. Never mind all of those nice Sufi poems, never mind the mercy of traditional Islamic ethics, never mind four madhabs and the diversity, the ambiguity-loving culture of pre-modern Islam. Let's find something that really can act as a megaphone for our insecurities so we can shout and shout and shout at anybody who disagrees with us even slightly. And that's taken many forms, and there are Shi'i as well as Sunni versions of it, and that hasn't really worked out too well anywhere at all, but has generated wars on terror and global polarizations, reinforced regimes, and it's not really had a very happy outcome, the kind of roll up into a ball like a hedgehog if you're threatened and be as prickly as possible, well, it's not really helping. It should be evident that in this age, we need to resource those generous aspects of our civilization, those which are more dialogical, those which are able to be flexible, those which do not hammer home the strictest interpretations of fiqh, but find dispensations for people who are really challenged and struggling in a fast-moving, modern, complicated, weird canary wharf. This is where people are. Logic and the purpose of religion, the maqasid of the sharia, indicates that we should be making things easier. And that's the prophetic commandment. Yassiru wa la tu'assiru, he used to say. Bashiru wa la tunaffiru. It's a commandment in a sound hadith. Make things easier, don't make them harder. Give people good news, don't repel them. Nowadays, a certain type of traumatized, furious, enraged Muslim soul is not happy with that and wants to turn it around. Let's look for the hardest possible interpretation. And when I found it, let me spend the whole afternoon on YouTube attacking people for not following the strictest possible interpretation. And then perhaps some peace comes to my soul because I'm feeling superior, at least to somebody. It's not really real religion. The Holy Prophet's instruction is clear. Make things easier, don't make them harder. ما خير رسول الله صلى الله عليه وسلم بين أمرين إلا واختار أيسرهما ما لم يكن فيه إثم. Never was the Holy Prophet, never, the hadith says, given the choice between two things, but that he chose the easier of them, as long as there was no sin in it. Nowadays, we're a little bit suspicious of people like that. Sometimes even this Deobandi Brailvi thing looks like an exercise in competitive narrowness. That's not real religion. Read Imam al-Ghazali, Kitab Dhamm al-Ghurur, in the Ihya to see how he hammers scholars who are competitively strict. This is not prophetic religion. This is just the ego playing tricks and making God's religion harder for people to carry, which is not the point. So there are these two alternatives that we find and that reflect themselves in curricula of various sorts. Surrender and just bring in the French curriculum into Algeria, or spit and curse and find something infinitely tougher than medieval fiqh and Islam in the hope that somehow that will make the problems go away. Now, those things are alive and well across the Muslim world. The middle ground, which is prophetically mandated and the meaning of a sirat al-mustaqim, seems to be less and less populated. But if you go into the libraries, as I do, you find the extremes are almost impossible to find. I remember once in Timbuktu, in one of the great libraries there, just before the Ansar al-Din extremists took over and messed everything up, went to the library, and I went with a couple of the guys who I'm sure later on became these jihadis, who went into the library, and this is a library with 80,000 manuscripts. A miracle, the city of scholars in the middle of the Sahara, Timbuktu. And these two guys went quieter and quieter, and I could see that they were really angry because there wasn't a single book that we saw that they could agree with. Maliki fiqh, no. Ash'ari theology, no. Sufi poetry, no, 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 no. They went past 80,000 books, no. This is the situation we're in, and it's sometimes very difficult for younger people to know what the tradition actually is. This beautiful culture of diversity and respect amongst the ulama, the beauty of traditional cosmopolitan Islam. The only thing they liked was the Quran manuscripts. And then they saw the riwayah, which they couldn't read, and they kind of got sad again. So yeah, something like that, of course, generates an enormous psychological explosion because they think the ulama are all guilty of treason. All of these scholars who wrote these 80,000 books, wrong, and we're right. Well, strange. You're semi-literate guys brought up in a stony desert, and you know better than Fakhruddin, all of these people. Well, that mentality exists. And that also generates a further sense of panic and rage and desire just to destroy everything. So that possibility is here, and the guy who killed David Amos not so far from here is something that is in our communities, and that is something that we need to create a scholarship that can resolve it. That's an urgent need. Prevent isn't going to sort it. Filling the prisons with radicals isn't going to sort the problem. They just convert other people in the prisons and it becomes worse. The solution has to come from us. We have to go to those people. Some Prevent social worker who's done a course in psychology of religion goes to some extreme radical and works. Doesn't work. You have to get into the heart of the thing. Quran, Sunnah, Hadith, everything, because that's the only language they'll understand. And you can't expect non-Muslim sociologists or spooks of various kinds, security services people, to be able to do that. They can't. Anyway, so we pride ourselves on the idea that what we are called to do at CMC is important. So to get back to the issue of how we can be rahmatun wa shifa, mercy and a healing in the society rather than just a kind of pain in the neck, is to see that this society is not where it was 100 years ago in the heyday of empire, when these docks were filled with ships that were going to Canada and Australia and India, and this was the biggest port in the world and the greatest city in the world and the biggest empire in the world. It's a bit different now. More ambiguous, more mercantile, less ideological, certainly less Christian. It's something else. And it has a lot of problems. So what if we reshape the agenda of our Islam to see not how we can campaign for better halal meat in the primary schools or whatever it is that we're usually on about. Things aren't quite as bad as that, but even 20 years ago they were. And to see what are the painful issues that are causing dysfunction here, and what do we have by way of resources to try and help people? Can we be helpers? Is that even just useful, because maybe it reduces the possibility of them getting fed up and putting us on a boat and sending us somewhere? Well, I would say, yep, better to be helpers, rahmatun wa shifa. So, and there are so many issues. This crisis of modernity, a lot of Muslims don't really realize it. Your average Gulf ruler, when he waddles around Harrods once a year with his flunkies and this and this and this and this, and this, and this, you can see them, doesn't know what's really going on in this culture, isn't really interested. He just wants it. He wants this shopping mall. He wants this skyscraper. He wants, because he just sees the surface of things that is kind of shiny. It's like a child. Many of the Muslim elites are like that. But there's a lot of problems here. If you've been brought up here, you'll see people are talking about it all the time. A crisis in identity. Look at this week's copy of The New Statesman. It's all about British identity. What are we? Quotes from George Orwell, and it's quite well done, actually. And the answer is, well, we aren't sure. The Americans kind of have a clear identity in the American Dream and McDonald's, and it's sort of, you can see what it is. What is a British identity in these times of devolution and Brexit and not sure? Well, that's worrying, because when people are not sure what they are, that tends to be when they find external enemies. That's when their own sense of insecurity makes them look for scapegoats. We need to watch out for that. Other crises that seem to be afoot, well, the collapse in the birth rate. Whatever happened to the sexual revolution? Nobody's having babies. Something's gone a bit wrong. Whatever happened to their biologism, they claim, the kind of Steven Pinker view, that all we are is biological blobs that exist to replicate themselves. That's all we are. Well, we're not even doing that, so what are we exactly? Well, we've got a Premier banking card from Barclays and we're doing something. But if we're not even replicating ourselves, something is really wrong. I went, this is a mixed environment, and I won't suggest ways in which we Muslims could directly try and solve that issue, but maybe it will occur to some of you. Other crisis issues. Demography is always one of the big things in history that causes, you know, caused the breakup of the Soviet Union. It's a big thing. What about mental health crises? Dr. Abdullah was talking about this a bit this afternoon. We're really sick. We have a crisis in the university sector, particularly amongst young women who are just having more problems with body image issues, with cutting, with self-harming, with dieting disorders, with panic attacks, with anxiety, with depression. Why is that, 50 years after women's liberation? Why are they all so sad? Why is there this absolute explosion of referrals to mental health services at the NHS when women's lib, women can do anything? They can go to the space station. What's going on? Nobody can even define what gender is any longer. Keir Starmer certainly ducks that question in Parliament. That's a fundamental lack of awareness. Well, whatever the definition might be, there should be one. That's another issue, another problem, another fundamental crisis. Other issues come to mind. What about existential risks to do with technology? Where is the Victorian triumphalism that said, these steam engines and vaccination and whatever is going to usher in a world of happiness? Not really happening. We have these existential risks. Nuclear weapons, people are worrying about again. But microplastics, various forms of subtle pollution, something in the water supply, the whole environmental catastrophe, which is really a catastrophe, is something that the modernists in their heyday 100 years ago didn't really expect, and the Muslims who went along behind them are now kind of wondering where the Pied Piper was leading them. They toddle along happily and obediently behind the Western cavalcade into the new promised land, and it's turning out to be dangerous. Our professor of astronomy at the University of Cambridge, Martin Rees, has a book called Our Final Century. He's the astronomer royal, significant person. He thinks probably humanity will wipe itself out within the next 100 years. Not because of some asteroid collision or other Hollywood scenario, but because we'll wipe ourselves out. So he has chapters on all of the things that are going to threaten us. New strains of illnesses escaping from some laboratory. Antibiotic-resistant forms of TB, maybe. Issues to do with artificial intelligence. Stephen Hawking, also in Cambridge, said, stop that research, because he believes in the sort of matrix, nightmare, dystopian possibility that sooner or later the internet is going to wake up and say, I'm smarter than you guys, I'm in charge, and we can't do without it, so we'll do what we're told. He thinks that's a real possibility, so it's something that we're studying, the possibility of an AI super explosion that wipes us out. Much of science fiction is about that, from Terminator onwards. It's a fear in our culture. Again, the Victorians never expected that. Questions to do with nanotechnology. Machines so small that you can hardly see them, or you can't see them at all. Great, you can put them inside the bloodstream and they can sort out somebody's blocked arteries. Brilliant. And they can build themselves, they can build other machines that are the same, and they're already doing that. Even at an atomic level, they can put atoms together and make tiny atomic-sized machines. Another problem, according to Martin Rees, that what's to stop these machines making more and more of themselves? How do you stop one little micro-machine from making another one that makes another one? How do you stop that process? So we have what they call, not quite humorously, the grey goo scenario. It's the kind of phrase that scientists like to use so that people pay attention to them. In other words, the whole world is taken over by one of these machines, which replicates itself until there's nothing left of the planet but grey goo. It seems to be a real possibility. Climate change, let's just get back to that. So what we're seeing is the consequence of increasing human technical capacity, more and more cleverness, without a matching increase in human wisdom. And certainly without any kind of public discourse about limits to growth, about saying enough. So sustainable development doesn't ask the question whether development is sustainable. Maybe it isn't. Maybe if all of those third world countries switch to our mode of production, the environment will collapse overnight, because at the moment, the climate crisis is not really the third world's fault. The average Westerner consumes 70 times as many resources as the average Bangladeshi. Unfortunately, the average Bangladeshi is the one who's going to be suffering most, because his village is disappearing underwater, because the river is misbehaving as a result of the melting of the Himalayan ice caps. It's going to be the poor, and particularly, if you look at the geography, the Muslim poor, who are going to suffer the most. The third pole, they call it, the Himalayan ice cap. Big new United Nations report with 300 scientists signed off on it. Within 40 years, the river valleys of Pakistan and Bangladesh will be uninhabitable, because the rain that fell as snow that would be trapped in the ice and released slowly to allow agriculture in the subcontinent is not going to happen any longer. Instead, you'll get these catastrophic flash floods that will make those countries uninhabitable. The report online and makes sobering reading. So clearly that's one of the big dysfunctions that science, technology, development has imposed upon us. So increasingly, the old Victorian, generally Eurocentric, triumphalist vision of progress, that the white man, the European, and the various people who settled in the ethnically cleansed colonies, North America, South America, Australia, New Zealand, bits of South Africa, Siberia, they've triumphed. They ruled the world, they've solved the problems. Well, they solve some problems. They have nice dentists, for instance, which is pretty good. But the problems that they're generating are threatening us in a way that was never imaginable before. The world was this incredible, complex balance of species and the climate and the currents of the sea and the tides, and it was sustainable for millions and millions and millions of years, with the exuberant cornucopia of living things. Human beings were part of that. We can live as part of that. In the Paleolithic, we were just part of the biological complex. But now we start to look a bit like a cancer. We're kind of one bit that's got out of control, and we're sick and we're destroying everything else, to the extent that the cancer may destroy the host organism. Which is why even the materialists are kind of waking up and saying, well, it wouldn't be so great if there was no air for our grandchildren to breathe. It becomes has to be that primitive before they actually get their snouts out of the trough and start to think this endless proliferation of consumption and gadgets has to stop. Human desires are infinite, have no limit. But the Earth's resources are finite. And sooner or later, there'll be a crisis, and we're starting to see that already. So we find that this incredible, supremely beautiful ball of green and blue, this jewel that God has put in the velvety darkness of space, this enormous thing, أَلَمْ تَكُنْ أَرْضُ اللَّهِ وَاسِعًا, has not God's earth been broad, isn't quite enough for our greed. So Elon Musk says, well, we'll just go to Mars. In other words, he wants to move, because of climate change, to a planet that has already been destroyed by climate change. There used to be water here, and maybe something was growing here. You want to move there? I don't think so. If that's really planet B, not very appealing. That's what this Earth may well be if we can't get out of this rut. So that, it seems to me, is one of the areas in which we can offer an input. Those of you who were with us last night at LSE will recall my rehearsing of the familiar Quranic verses and the hadiths about the natural world. A natural world which is not just there to supply treats for an endlessly greedy and egotistic humanity, but a natural world which exists on its own terms as an endless cornucopia of proliferating and endlessly different and unique divine signs. إِنَّ فِي خَلْقِ السَّمَوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضِ وَاخْتِلَافِ اللَّيْلِ وَالنَّهَارِ لَآيَاتٍ لِأُولِي الْأَلْبَابِ. So much of the Quran is about this. Nature, you don't find much of that in the New Testament, really, except the bit where Jesus casts out demons and they go into pigs and they jump off a cliff, which a lot of evangelical Christians find a bit uncomfortable because they like to have the Big Mac with the bacon, so when they realize Jesus wasn't into that, it makes them a bit twitchy. But otherwise, there's not much about the animals in the New Testament. Why is the Quran full of this? Truly, in the succession of night and day, and the creation of the heavens and the earth, are signs for people of understanding. It is the book of nature. Throughout, many people comment on this. Have they not seen? Have they not seen? Have they not seen? And that's for us as well. Even though when you walk around Canary Wharf, you may suffer from what you might call nature deficit disorder. There's a bird there. Wow. Otherwise, not a blade of grass. It's what it is. It's not good for us. Because there's something about being surrounded by natural materials and natural things which triggers in us a recollection of how we were for 99% of human history, which is hunter-gatherers. We respond to nature, which spiritually nourishes us. This morning I was walking through Oxford. They have these beautiful old walls of ashlar stone. And I was reflecting on the fact that the older they get, the more beautiful they get. Little bits of grass and kind of mold, even if the mold is cut, it's all beautiful. And then you see the concrete buildings from the 1970s, and the older they get, the uglier they get. Very interesting that something in the brain has that instinctive reaction, that we are programmed to respond positively to what is natural because we are biologically part of the natural world and because that's how our forefathers for tens of thousands of generations lived. The child wants to touch the animal. It's amazed by the doggy and the duck, and that's natural to us. But we're suffering from this nature deficit disorder because this crazy runaway turbo capitalism is killing the animals. The last rhino or the last whatever, and then there's some nice Attenborough documentary about how the last Siberian tiger has been saved, and we're supposed to say, hooray, the last one. It's like genocide. If the Quran is saying that the birds and the animals are umamun amthalukum, as it says in Surah Al-An'am, nations like yourselves, then to wipe them out is a kind of genocide, I guess. They're also ummas. That in itself is sufficient argument against this thing called progress. But they don't get the vote. Nobody goes to the hedgehog that's trying to cross the A14 asking it if it really appreciates the modern world. We don't really ask them, we just squash them. Globally, this is a huge holocaust of the other ummas that have been created to praise and to worship God and to testify to his unity and his creative power, wiping them all out. So, as well as destroying our life support system, we are also destroying God's signs by which he reveals his nature to us. Because the Quran says, "Ayatin li ulil albab." It's an argument from design, but it's not so much cerebral as spiritual. When you're surrounded by virgin nature, you inhale something that you know is cleansing and that will lead you on. read any narrative from Native American spirituality or people who are still remember how things were before the white man came and the local Wendy's was opened and Dairy Queen and alcohol and the thing became decrepit, but how things used to be. And it's all about experiencing the sacred in nature, in the animals, in the mountains, and that's normal for human beings. If we're wiping it out, then we wipe out that theology, no longer accessible. So that's why, to get to the end of this point that I'm trying to make, we should be leading the charge against climate change. Not just because we want our grandchildren to be able to see fish or to breathe air that isn't going to give them asthma or whatever is in store for us, but because those other orders of creation have a divinely appointed right to be here, and because they sustain our faith. Beauty indicates its source. As Plato said, beauty is the splendor of the truth. When contemplating beauty, the heart is stilled, and we see beyond the surface of the thing to the order which makes it beautiful. All of Islamic art is about that. If we can no longer do that, because the whole world is Canary Wharf, or we're living underground on Mars, or whatever Mr. Musk thinks is the solution, that's not going to be so easy. So that's why not just Muslims, but religionists generally, but particularly I think we as proud holders of the Quran, this book which is all about nature, should be on those Greenpeace ships. We should be on those marches. We should be protesting, really protesting, for these reasons. The Muslim world is going to be destroyed first, because our faith depends on the ongoing beauty of the spiritual life support system, which the natural world represents. And also because, you know, it'd be nice if our grandchildren could see fish and birds, and it'd be pretty nice. So that's really what I'm getting at. We're not paying the rent in this earthly home, and the landlord is fed up with us. Finally, really patient. Hundreds of years of chimneys and God knows what going on in the depths of the ocean. Every last bit of it, we have to interfere with it. But finally, I guess the divine patience is running out. We're not paying the rent, and so the property is not being maintained, and eventually we may get the eviction order. Too bad, Bani Adam. We gave you this planet, but you're not really looking after it terribly well at all. And so, well, maybe that's the end. Israfil does his thing on the Rock of Jerusalem. That's the end, when human beings have caused these calamities. Maybe nobody knows the future except the designer of the future. But the point is, I think, the rather elementary one, which is that instead of being in these Western countries kind of hoping for crumbs from the banquet of the materialistic elites, instead we should be seeing what we can do to reduce the neuralgic consequences of modernity. All of these depressed young people worried about climate change, worrying about all of these other existential threats. It's not a happy generation. And yeah, if we've been brought mubashirin, bringers of good news, bashiru wa la tunafiru, the Prophet commands us, give people good news, cheer them up, don't repel them. Repel them, well, that's the job of the Taliban or the guy with the suicide belt. He's really successful in repelling them. Great job. Don't need all of these Islamophobic think tanks. Just one of those guys has a bigger effect. But this Bashiru, give people good news. Yeah, that's what we should be doing. And that should be the slogan, the motto, really, of every mosque in England and around the world. How can we sort out the problems of our neighbours using the riches of our tradition? Do we really understand them? Do they understand us? Have we conveyed the message? Have we invited them to our iftars? Do they know about what we represent? Have they read those amazing passages in the Quran about the animal orders and the fish and the bird and the book of nature? Probably not. usually not. They see this strange building on the street where people can't park properly. It has a kind of pointy dome, and they think, well, we have to be multicultural. That's as far as it goes, usually. No, we have to go a little bit beyond that. If we want to survive, if we can show that we're really useful, and we can stop God from chucking us off the planet, if we can do that, then people will say, you're a blessing. Khayra ummatin ukhrijat linnas, the best of communities raised up for mankind. We have these resources, Quran, Sunnah, the incredible literature, art, thought of classical Islam, those libraries in the desert with 80,000 books. We can use that as the energy banks for a new sort of Islam in these places, where we stop being defensive and start to embrace, stop complaining about our own pains and see how we can help the pains of others. This is Quranically mandated. Idfa' billati hiya ahsan. Repel hostility with something better. And then you will see the one between whom you and him was hostility. Ka'annahu waliyun hamim. It will be as if he's your closest friend. That's the way to defeat Islamophobia. And I can't see a better way of doing that than reconfiguring ourselves as the green ummah, the green deen, who care about these things, because you have to care about them, leading the charge rather than sheepishly following at a distance. So inshallah, we'll think about that. And you know, Barclays financial institutions with their ethical codes of responsibility have their own ways of looking about these things. They recognize the gravity of the threat that we face. And it's one of the things that we care about at CMC as well. Green khutbahs, sustainability khutbahs. Let's see how we can stay on this planet. That kind of khutbah, I think, is important.